Cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Listen Up with Jim Potts, only on LA Talk Radio.
Jim Potts back on the air, and as always, thank you so much for sharing your Sunday evening with me. What I want to talk about today is going to be really like three major issues, although there's a couple of emails in here that's going to have me talking about some other things as well. First thing we're going to talk about are border tunnels, the Border Tunnel Prevention Act. You know, a lot of people don't even know that there's such a law in place, and with everything that's going on right now with the issue at the border and everything, I think it's kind of important to at least give you that information. Second thing we're going to talk about, you've heard me talk over the weeks about lone wolves. Well, today we're going to talk about the characteristics of lone wolves and showing you some differences, who they are, what they're all about, et cetera. And then the third thing we're going to talk about, you know how I like historical pieces and things of that nature. Somebody's actually made an inquiry to me about the Ku Klux Klan, how they got started, the whole nine yards. So we're going to be talking about that history today as well, and clearing up some myths about that. Okay, let's start off with the emails. Mr. Potts, I've heard a number of stories how the NRA got started. Can you clarify the real story? Ben from Oklahoma. The NRA. Yeah, well, Ben, I normally stay away from political things, but just to talk about the history of an organization to me is not really so much political. But I will tell you that the NRA was actually founded, believe it or not, in 1871. I mean, it goes back that far. And the reason it got started by a couple of Union Army officers, they were kind of disillusioned that so many of the Northern soldiers, they were often poorly trained, and they had been scarcely capable of using their own weapons. And this really kind of surprised them. You know, the Southerners, they, I guess, were using their weapons in a different way because they were using them probably for hunting and things of that nature. With some of the Northern boys, especially in the cities and things of that nature, they weren't really proficient with their weapons. But I have to tell you something, is that the concept of the NRA was not new even at that time. Believe it or not, there was a organization in the UK. Britain had the National Rifle, so the Britain National Rifle Association. So basically, is what they ended up doing was kind of piggybacking the name of the NRA, but it really kind of started off in England. Now, the initial group of the NRA was led by Colonel William Church and General George Wingate. Those are names familiar to those of you who weren't falling asleep in your high school history classes, and they were very concerned, so they set about addressing the problem of producing a better American marksman. And they actually set up all of these contests and things of that nature, and England was already doing things like that as well. So the National Rifle Association was actually first chartered, though, in the state of New York, my home state, November 16th, 1871. And like I said, the concern from the this is taken from Union Army records, is that I don't want to call them American troops because I think that they were all Americans, but the Union troops had fired about 1,000 rifle shots for each Confederate hit. And that's why some of these generals were really concerned. One general, General Burnside, said out of 10 soldiers who are perfect in drill, and the manual of arms, and that's all the drills, you see them marching back and forth and all of that, only one knows the purpose of the sights of his gun or could hit the broadside of a barn. So a lot of these troops actually just simply did not know what they were doing, and they were having to teach them from the basics. And, you know, back then they were carrying muskets. So they had to teach them the sights. They had to teach them how to shoot and the rest of that. So that's why they felt that there was something more that had to be done. So they set about this task, and I can tell you that's what happened was it quickly took on in this country. They actually, in 1934, So all of those years later, they actually formed the Legislative Affairs Division because they needed them to be able to act on a national level. And by 1940, there were more civilian gun clubs than actually golf clubs in this country. So once they started getting into it, they really truly started getting into it, and it really took off for them. Now, I can also tell you that it wasn't until the mid-1970s that the NRA started to focus not just on sportsmen hunting, target shooting, etc. They at that time, gun control was starting to become an issue, so they were kind of downplaying it during that time frame. Now, is what ended up happening was the growing number of NRA gun right activists started, you know, showing their or rearing their ugly heads, so to speak. And in 1975, it became more of a focus on politics and establishing lobbying, you know, for this. And you look at that and say, okay, let's look at that time frame. We had a lot of civil unrest. Think about it. The 60s, early 70s. And now this was becoming a political machine. And I can tell you in 1977, the organization expanded its membership by focusing heavily on political issues and then forming coalitions with conservative politicians. Now the NRA has been described as influential in shaping American gun control policy, and the organization actually does influence legislators' voting behavior through its financial resources and ability to be able to mobilize its large membership. So now it really has become sort of like a political machine. And I can tell you that the organization has not lost a major battle over gun control legislation since 1994. And that was the, if you remember right, for those of you that are old enough to remember, the federal assault weapons ban. But other than that, they've been a force in this country, politically speaking. And that's why when you see things on the news and they talk about the NRA and the fact that they've got the ability with their membership to be able to influence some of these political outcomes, that's why. But it didn't start off like that, Ben. So as you can see, it started off probably for all the right reasons, just basically teaching people how to shoot. Now, of course, the Army has that responsibility now, fathers with their kids or whatever the case may be. And now there's a whole, you know, large contingency of people that are learning how to use guns because of everything that the country has been going through. So it'll be interesting to see with the more people that are becoming more proficient with the use of firearms and getting to know more about firearms, whether or not the membership of the NRA is going to be growing. And if that membership grows, obviously it can have political ramifications. But at least that's how it got started, Ben. So thanks for your email. By the way, if anybody has any questions about any of this, you can always call me at 818-602-4929. And you can always email me, as you know, listenupwithjp@pottsandassociates.com. Okay, the next area that I wanted to talk about was this this business about the caravans. Politically speaking, I really don't want to get into it, but let me just tell you, somebody wrote in and says, I know you want to stay neutral about politics, but this caravan of people coming and forcing themselves on our country scares me. Can't some of those people be terrorists, Susan? Well, yes, I don't deny that. I don't, and I think that's why some of the politicians are actually pushing for this as well, because there is a fear that, in fact, some of these people, although we know that some of the people are coming here to better their lives, there are those who are also coming here possibly within those groups trying to cause problems. So I can only tell you that our country is doing what they can, but there's no 100% that we're going to be able to protect from anything and everything that might happen. Now, because of this email, Susan, I will tell you that I will also be talking about the border tunnels as well, because I think that they all tie in together, because we're just looking at a caravan of people coming, and this is not the first caravan. Some people say it's politically motivated. I really don't want to get into the politics of whether or not it is politically motivated or not. But, you know, I do believe there are people who just want to come in here to better their lives. And that part I understand. So I will be talking about the Border Tunnel Prevention Act, because I think it ties in directly to your email. The third email that I wanted to talk about, before I get into the main subject areas that I laid out for you, was that, Jim, it's obvious that we are now living in a dangerous world. ISIS and Al-Qaeda are well known because they have been all over the news. But what about these single attackers? How does the average person spot these people? Can you give some perspectives on what to look for? And that's signed by Alicia. Look, I will tell you that there are some myths out there about some of this. So I did a little research to get the three standard myths about these individuals. And the first one is, and this ties directly into your questions, Alicia, is that myth one, they fit a distinct profile. Well, that's a myth. Attackers do not fit one descriptive or demographic profile. The second myth is that they're all mentally ill attackers and that they're irrational in their planning. Well, the true fact is mentally ill attackers have developed organized and rational attack plans as well. So you just can't go by that and say everybody that does this is mentally ill. I get it in terms of the fact that, you know, people who just shoot and kill people like this, that there must be something wrong with them. I mean, I understand that as a concept. The third myth is that they make a direct threat. Well, fact three, persons who pose an actual threat most often do not make a threat. They just do it. And I even have those conversations with clients sometimes, because clients will say, hey, this guy just threatened everybody in here, and that puts people on notice. The other day, I was at one of my clients, it's a school, and they were saying how a second grader told another second grader that they were going to, that the second grader was going to go home and get his daddy's gun out of the gun safe and come back and shoot him. And of course, you know what happens as a result of that. These days, anytime any of that kind of language happens, you know what's going to happen. So obviously, a school is going to go into, you know, the frame of mind that you have to take every one of these complaints seriously, all the parents were notified, et cetera, and you have to do it that way. But here's a second grader. There's nothing mentally ill with that second grader. He made a threat. That's what it was. But oftentimes, they don't make the threats. They just do it. Now, yes, some of the school shooters have had conversations with their peers or mentioned things to their parents and everything, you know, about what they were going to do. But there's a difference between those kind of things and threats as well. So at any rate, Alicia, those are the myths. You say what to look for. It is very difficult to know what to actually look for. But those were the three standard myths that people think, and hopefully that will kind of clarify some things for you. All right? Okay, having gotten that behind us, let's talk about these border tunnels. Look, you know, a lot of you know that when I was doing my work on the intelligence team, that one of the things we looked at were things like the tunnels and the things in South America and Central America, which was my area. And there's no secret about these tunnels. These tunnels have been around a long time. Now, what the general public is not aware of, I would think, and I can't speak for everybody, some people out there that might be aware of it, was that they have what they call the Border Tunnel Prevention Act of 2012. So this has actually only been around for 6 years. Now, I will tell you that the reason they did it is that Congress found the following, that trafficking and human and smuggling organizations are intensifying their efforts to enter the United States through tunnels and other subterranean passages between Mexico and the United States. Again, we're talking about people coming and marching and trying to just walk across the border. But understand, underground, there's a lot of issues that's going on in there with these tunnels. Border tunnels, according to the report that they did to Congress, are most often used to transport narcotics from Mexico to the United States, but can also be used to transport people and other contraband. It's there. It's there. Now, between 1990 and 2011, law enforcement authorities discovered 149 cross-border tunnels along the border between Mexico and the United States, 139 which had been discovered through fiscal year 2001, and there had been a dramatic increase in the number of cross-border tunnels discovered in Arizona and California way back since 2006, and 40 tunnels were discovered in California and 74 tunnels discovered in Arizona, just to give you that breakdown. Now, when you think about this, this is a report to Congress that they did back in 2012, but even since then, that's the only report they have from what I can find in my research. But just think about it. This is a difference of 6 years. So in 6 years, you tell me what you think is going on. There's probably even more tunnels at this point. But this just alerted Congress to the fact that there's something that needs to be done about these tunnels. Now, I will also tell you that as a result of this act, that it criminalizes the construction or financing of an unauthorized tunnel or subterranean passage across an international border into the United States. And that's why these political elections are so important, that you're seeing all of this on the news now with Arizona and California and even into Texas, because there's a lot of concerns about all of this. The act also prohibits any person from recklessly permitting others to construct or use an unauthorized tunnel or subterranean passage on a person's land. Now, if you watch the news often enough, you will see where some of the landowners, people that have these big cattle ranches and things of that nature, are complaining that these individuals, you know, are coming through onto their land. Now, the act also included any person convicted of using a tunnel or subterranean passage to smuggle aliens, weapons, drugs, terrorists, or illegal goods is subject to an enhanced sentence for the underlying offense. Let me explain what an enhanced sentence means. It basically means that maybe ordinarily for a crime you get 5 years, but when it's an enhanced sentence, it's because they consider it so bad that they will add on an additional amount of years to whatever the statutory penalty would be. So that's why. So that's what that's all about. So it's not like the government's not trying to do something. And again, these tunnels are, you know, these tunnels are a big deal. Now, federal agents have also uncovered drug smuggling tunnels underneath the U.S.-Mexican border facing and servicing in San Diego around warehouses and equipped with rail systems for moving contraband. Now, think about that. They've got, I'm sitting up here looking at some of these pictures. They've got tunnels with rail systems that are coming through. And one of the discoveries in this tunnel, and this is, by the way, it's recently within the last couple of years. This particular tunnel that they found led to the arrest of a 73-year-old woman accused of running one of the warehouses connected to a drug smuggling operation. Now, what that's about is that when they have the tunnels, these tunnels are coming in, they're coming under the ground, and they're coming up into the warehouses. So that's how they do it. So you just don't see them out in the open. So the Border Patrol agents aren't going to necessarily see them. Now, these particular tunnels were discovered as a part of a 5-month investigation. They actually have a task force called the San Diego Tunnel Task Force. What does that tell you? They've got a specific name for a specific task force regarding tunnels. Now, they said that and this was the federal officials, of course, said that the first tunnel that they found here more recently connects a warehouse in Tijuana, Mexico. So basically, it starts off in TJ and comes all the way through into an industrial park in the border community of Otay Mesa. It's about 600 yards long and is furnished with lighting, crude rail system, and wooden trusses. I mean, this is a sophisticated operation, all underground. How can border agents possibly spot all of that, especially if the end of the tunnels is coming up into a warehouse? And this particular tunnel, the passageway is accessed via a 70-foot shaft secured by a cement cover and includes a pulley system on the United States side, apparently intended to hoist contraband up into the warehouse. I'm telling you, this gets to be really, really incredible about how people can be so sophisticated with some of this. And as you know, it's against the law. And remember, they don't just use it for drugs. They use it for human trafficking also. The second tunnel was even more sophisticated because it was built with a multi-tiered electric rail system, an array of ventilation equipment, because obviously if it's so far down under the ground, then they got to get air. So this particular tunnel even has it where they have, a ventilation system, so people don't smother. So, you know, again, when you look at what's going on, and these individuals and people talking about walls, or they're talking about trying to keep people back. You know, you can see what all the controversies are back. I'm trying to maintain neutrality with this. Obviously, I'm not in favor of tunnels, and I'm not in favor of them using these tunnels for smuggling drugs, especially because we know that there's a big opioid problem in this country, and that's definitely a contributing factor. Again, if you have any comments about any of this, call me at 818-602-4929. Okay, that was kind of the second one that I wanted to talk to you about. Again, that's the Border Tunnel Prevention Act, and there should be some more information out there on it. I'm operating under a limited amount of time, so I really don't want to go any more into detail, but it gives you the at least the idea and the flavor for what's, you know, what's going on. So the caravans are one thing, but I feel that the bigger concern are these tunnels, because, again, the tunnels are also bringing in drugs, and I think that's a major problem for this country. You know, somebody asked me the other day about marijuana, and they said, well, do you think that marijuana is a contributing factor the argument is always that marijuana is a gateway drug, and you start using marijuana, you're going to start using other things. Look, I have no total idea about that. And some people will say, well, it's, you know, now that they've legalized it, let me just clarify. It's still a federally controlled substance. So it's not totally legal. And the other day I was watching the news, and they had a headline saying that Canada is the second country to legalize marijuana. And I looked at that title, I thought to myself, that's not accurate. That's not an accurate statement. Canada is a country, yes. United States is a country, yes. But the country of the United States has not legalized marijuana. Some of the states have done that. But as a country, no. And the use of marijuana is not legalized in all states. So just as a point of clarification. Okay? All right. Let's move on. Let's talk about these lone wolf characteristics, because I think that's important as well. I'm going to start off by giving you a rough overview about the characteristics of a lone wolf personality, because I think that's important. So, get your pens out if that's what you want to do. The first thing for you to understand about lone wolves is that they are good listeners. They listen before they speak, and they also watch from the sidelines, and to be honest with you, they take mental notes before they insert themselves into any social situation. And that preparation allows them to enter a conversation, you know, with confidence, without stumbling over their words or doubting the accuracy of what they're saying. So they're good listeners. Number two, they're self-sufficient. They are not dependent on people. They believe it is foolish to depend on another person to take care of their material needs. This freedom makes them feel empowered because they know they can manage any curveball that life might throw at them. Number three, they are super focused. Super focused. They concentrate with everything they've got. They make a good point of paying attention to nonverbal cues that might reveal hidden meanings, because they know words are only half of the story. This ability helps them avoid potential misunderstandings. The fourth one, they're easy to please. They don't need much to feel happy and content, people. They would rather stay home and enjoy a good book or a bubble bath than go to a loud bar and buy expensive drinks. This distinction helps them save money and relax after stressful days. Next one, number five, they are very observant. They identify changes in their environment very quickly. They will probably be the first person to notice a new haircut. This often causes their friends and coworkers to thank them for being so thoughtful. Number six, listen to this. They are trustworthy people. They can keep secrets, and that's better than most of you out there probably. They know how hard it can be to trust somebody, so they won't share personal detail if you don't want them to. This is exactly why introverts are excellent best friends. All right. Now, you obviously know that this is, you know, not just my opinions. This is based on research that I found that's out there. Now, the next characteristics, and I'm going to talk about some of these other things as well, but I'm just trying to give you some basics here, is that they're in touch with their feelings. and they're masters at their emotions. They reflect until they are able to understand the triggers that are responsible for their negative thoughts. This retrospection helps them dig deep enough to deal with entrenched self-defeating beliefs that limit their potential. The last one I want to give you, before I get into some of the other things about these individuals, is that they are thought-provoking when you get them talking. They have interesting things to say. They might not be fans of small talk, but that doesn't mean that they can't be engaging in deep discussion. This distinction is a common source of confusion. Introverts are often considered to be quiet, but that's not because they don't like people. They just don't like to talk about trivial things. Introverts really are passionate people who want to make the most of their days, so they'd rather not waste their time with a shallow conversation. If you want to find out how fascinating an introvert can be, simply ask them an intelligent question about a topic. That's what they care about. And if they care about that topic, you're going to get yourself a discussion. So now those are some basic characteristics that I wanted to be able to share with you. Now, what I want to do is get into some of this other concerns, etc. And when I say concerns, it's because as a nation, there is this concern about these individuals, these lone wolves. They're a phenomenon. Now, one person who is deranged, so to speak, or driven by a hateful ideology, they can do a lot of damage. And it's a lot harder to trace lone wolves and what they and who they are and what they do. Now, one of the most notorious lone wolf terrorists was Ted Kaczynski. Now, I'm sure you remember him, who gave up a position as an assistant professor of mathematics at the University of California, Berkeley, to live in a remote area of Montana. You guys might remember him. He went there because he felt that he could escape the threat of the issues with technology. He didn't like progress in that area. So he had actually come to fear it and detest it. That's why he moved out there and he emerged himself occasionally from his wilderness cabin to carry these mail bombs to people he saw as and forwarded it, if you recall, to individuals. And then what did happen? It exploded. So that's how he was killing people. Now, you could do a flip side of that, and you could talk about John Allen Muhammad. Now, how many of you remember John Allen Muhammad and Lee Boyd Malvo? You guys don't remember those guys? They were actually African-American. Remember, they were in the D.C. area? They killed 10 people. They were snipers and wounded two more in 47 days of sniper attacks carried out in and around Washington, D.C. This goes back to 2002, for those of you who don't remember. Now, John Allen Muhammad, converted to Islam and favored black separation. And according to Malvo, he had hoped to extort $7 million from the United States government and use the money to fund a pure black community in Canada. This guy wasn't all there. And I'm not talking about because of his conversion. I'm talking about what he actually thought he could do. How do you think that you're going to extort $7 million so you can start a black community in Canada? Well, he tried. And for those of you who don't remember, he was caught. Young Malvo was caught. Malvo is still in jail, but John Allen Muhammad was actually executed in Virginia. And I'm going to tell you something. You want to know something about Virginia? Virginia was the first state to actually carry out an execution, a hanging. This goes back a couple of hundred years ago, but they were the first one to have capital punishment. Virginia doesn't play. Now, I will tell you, in recent years, lone wolf terrorism seems to become more frequent. Now, you should already know that. I mean, it's obvious if you just watch the news. And it never ceases to amaze me when I'm doing some of this training, active shooter training, and I'm telling people about different incidents that have happened on the news lately, and people give you this glassy stare, and you have to look at them and say, did you hear about what happened on the news? No. A lot of people don't watch the news. That's amazing to me. These days, you have to watch the news in order for you to be able to keep up with what's going on out there. Now, I will tell you with these lone wolves, in each case, the perpetrator seem to have acted alone for motives that are at least in part political. But beyond this similarity, there are striking differences in age, background, and motivation. They're not consistent with any of this in terms of who they are. So there's no perfect profile for a lone wolf. Now, understand something. Some people say, well, these guys are assassins. Can they be considered assassins? Look, these assassins and school attackers are not usually called terrorists, because that's another thing that I was asked. Assassins and school attackers resemble like one, I mean, it's close. A lone wolf is a lone wolf. But they do. Assassins, school attackers, and lone wolves, you could say that they resemble in three ways. They plan to perpetrate violence. The great majority act alone, and the great majority act out of some perceived grievance rather than for material self-interest. Now, let's look at what makes them a terrorist, because that's the issue. A lone wolf terrorist plans and carries out an attack, people, without assistance or organizational support. And most analysis of terrorism emphasize the power of group dynamics that can move normal individuals to commit horrific violence. But the distinct aspect of lone wolf terrorists is that they are moved to violent action without group or organizational support. That's why they are called lone wolves. They don't want the other pieces to the puzzle. Now, again, people who do this, you look at them and say, okay, come on, you talked about the myths. Do they have some kind of mental, you know, disorder? Now, victims of terrorism and mass media accounts of terrorism often see terrorists like this as suffering from some kind of, you know, as if they're psychopaths. Terrorists appear to be insane because they kill, destroy, and injure for motives that seem utterly incomprehensible to the rest of us. And it is plausible that these abnormal crimes, including killing and maiming citizens, must be the work of an abnormal individual, people suffering from some kind of mental disorder. But I can tell you, research shows that decades of research have made it clear, and most have agreed, that terrorists are no more likely to suffer, you know, from some kind of mental disorder than non-terrorists from the same backgrounds, nor are the terrorists more economically deprived or disadvantaged. It doesn't matter about their background. We've had some where they were financially well off, and you have to wonder what happened. It was something in their upbringing. You've heard me use the word people becoming radicalized on the internet. And people do become radicalized on the internet. And, you know, I try to encourage people to make sure that they know what their kids are doing and what they're not doing. These are important things these days. You know, back in the day, our parents would just tell us, go outside and play. We didn't have computers and things of that nature. And in terms of TV, yeah, we had TV. How many stations? Come on, some of you, you know what I'm talking about. How many stations do we have in those black and white TVs back in those days? Maybe seven, you know, whatever it may have been. So it was a whole different ball game now. People have an opportunity now with these internets, these handhelds, and things of that nature to become radicalized. Parents, some of you heard me say this before. You've got to watch your kids. You've got to understand who they are and what they're doing. And when they come to you and they start suggesting things and talking about things, you got to stop and pay attention to what they're saying. Your failure to do that could create a situation where you're home watching the news at night and all of a sudden you find out that your child has done something horrific. It's too late then. We've got to take control of this. Somebody asked me the other day, they said, well, you know, how are we ever going to manage these lone wolf situations? It is very difficult. You've heard me say this before. It is extremely difficult even for law enforcement. Barack Obama started addressing the issue of lone wolves, and he did point out, I think I mentioned that, you know, before, that these lone wolf terrorism situations are the most difficult for us to be able to handle, because it's just an individual that's motivated by their own desires or their own misconceptions. Who knows? All right. That gives you an idea about some lone wolf characteristics. From there, I want to move into this business about the Ku Klux Klan. Look, this is a very, very sensitive area for people. And the reason why I point them out is because when we talk about the number of groups, and I think I've mentioned to you, and if I haven't mentioned it to you, I just did a speech a couple of days ago. And in that speech, I pointed out that there's 954 hate groups in this country. 954. And California was one of the leading states at 75. Those are shocking numbers. But at any rate, and when I got to thinking about that and this business about the Ku Klux Klan, and somebody asked me about this business with the Ku Klux Klan, and I know we generally have a good understanding about them. We know that they started off in the South. But I want to give you some information that will clear up any misunderstandings and give you a little bit more concrete information. Look, the Ku Klux Klan was and is undeniably a terrorist organization. Let's start out with understanding that. And there's a lot of chapters right now with them. I think there's 190 chapters now of the Ku Klux Klan. But what made the Klan an especially insidious terrorist organization and a threat to civil liberties was that it functioned as the unofficial paramilitary arm of the Southern segregationist governments. Now, that allowed its members to kill with impunity and allowed Southern segregationists to eliminate activists by force without alerting federal authorities. And although the Klan is much less active today, and I know I gave you a number of 194, but you don't really hear them on the news like they were at one time during the 40s, 50s, and 60s, etc. It's always going to be remembered as an instrument of cowardly Southern politicians who hid their faces behind hoods and their ideology behind an unconvincing facade of patriotism. All right? Now, let's look at this a little deeper. Why and how did they get started? Well, let's start out with the basics. The KKK, which is the nickname that everybody is familiar with, it was founded actually in 1866. It extended into almost every Southern state by 1870 and became a vehicle for white Southern resistance to the Republican Party's Reconstruction era. Their policies were aimed at establishing political and economic equality for blacks. Now understand something. Did you hear what I said? They became a vehicle for white Southern resistance to the Republican Party's Reconstruction. So it was the Republican Party that was in charge of the Reconstruction of the South after the war. Now, the members of the KKK waged an underground campaign of intimidation and violence directed at white and black Republican leaders. And then finally, Congress passed legislation that was designed to curb Klan terrorism. And the organization saw its primary goal, the reestablishment of white supremacy, fulfilled through democratic victories in state legislatures across the South in the 1870s. And after a period of decline, white Protestant groups revived the Klan in the early 20th century. That's when you saw it in the movies about burning crosses and staging rallies, parades and marches, denouncing immigrants, Catholics, Jews, blacks, and organized labor. They basically hated everybody. The civil rights movement of the 1960s also saw a surge of the KKK activity, including bombings of black schools and churches and violence against black and white activists in the South. But now here's what's interesting. Most people, when they think about the KKK, they're thinking Republicans. It was just the opposite. They were more on the other side than they were on, more on the Democratic side than they were on the Republican side. It was the Republicans that were putting blacks into offices and things of that nature during the Reconstruction era. And the KKK members did not like this. Now, when it was founded by a group of former Confederate veterans, and they had their first meeting. It was in Tennessee in 1866. So Tennessee, 1866, to answer your questions directly, that was the state where the KKK was first organized. Now, the organization of the KKK coincided with the beginning of the second phase of the post-Civil War Reconstruction. Reconstruction, don't forget, was after the Civil War. It was designed in two phases to try to get the South back on their feet, basically, I guess is what you want to call it. But it was put into place by the more radical members of the Republican Party in Congress because, remember, again, to the victor goes the spoils. I mean, you've heard that expression. So after rejecting President Andrew Johnson, now remember, Andrew Johnson came into office after Lincoln was assassinated. So after Johnson's relatively lenient Reconstruction policies that was put in place between 1865 and 1866, Congress passed the Reconstruction Act over his veto. And under the provisions, the South was divided into five military districts, and each state was required to approve the 14th Amendment, which granted equal protection of the Constitution to former slaves and enacted universal male suffrage. So once again, you see what party was in fact behind making sure that the freed slaves were protected under the Constitution. Now, the violence started. Because you have to go back in time once again. From 1867 onward, African-American participation in public life in the South became one of the most radical aspects of Reconstruction because blacks were winning elections to Southern state governments and even to the United States Congress. And for its part, the KKK dedicated itself to an underground campaign of violence against Republican leaders and voters, both black and white, in an effort to reverse the policies of radical Reconstruction and restore white supremacy in the South. That's the easy way to remember why were they formed. And I know in some other shows I've mentioned this, that, and who knows, I do so many seminars and speeches, it could have been one of those where I talked about the fact that the whites were beginning to feel like they were the underdogs and they started fighting back for their own rights. Now, these KKK members were joined in their struggle by similar organizations such as the Knights of the White Camellia, and that came out of Louisiana. So I know I've got some Louisiana listeners out of there. So theirs were the Knights of the White Camellia and the White Brotherhood. And at least 10% of the black legislators elected during 1867 to 1868, the Constitutional Conventions, became victims of violence during Reconstruction, including even seven that were killed. White Republicans that were termed to be carpetbaggers and scallywags. I'm sure you've seen that terminology before. And black institutions such as schools and churches, they became symbols of black autonomy. Those were the targets by the KKK. Anything that stood out like that, the KKK was going after. They did not want those kind of symbols out there. Now, Klan activity flourished, you know, particularly in the regions of the South where blacks were a minority or small majority of the population and was relatively limited in others. And the reason for that is obviously is because in certain parts of the South where you had much more blacks, they would have to be more careful because they would be in the minority. The whites would be in the minority. But in some of these other smaller communities where the blacks were the minorities, those were the ones suffering more. Now, believe it or not, among the most notorious zones, the KKK, South Carolina. January 1871, 500 masked men attacked the Union County Jail and lynched 8 black prisoners in South Carolina. 500. You needed 500 people to be able to lynch 8 people? You know, that just goes to show you how bad that this was at one time. The KKK, people know that they were out of control. You don't see as much as you did, you know, back in those days, but again, it is what it is. Now, is what happened was the Ku Klux Klan actually faded for the longest time. The Great Depression was a part of that. In the 1930s, it depleted the membership ranks, and the organization temporarily disbanded even in 1944. Okay, what's 1944, guys? That's around what? World War II. And who knows, some of these people may have been fighting overseas, or it could have been any of those things. And then the civil rights movement of the 1960s saw the surge of local Klan activity across the South again. again, bombings, beatings, shootings of blacks and white activists. And then these actions carried out in secret, but apparently the work of local Klansmen. It outraged the nation and helped win support for the civil rights cause. And that's why Lyndon Johnson in 1965, where he turned around and delivered a speech publicly condemning the Klan and announcing the arrest of four Klansmen in connection with the murder of a white female civil rights worker in Alabama. Now, for those of you that are old enough to remember, Alabama, those states, Mississippi, a number of those states, these were major issues, Georgia, that, you know, the Klan was operating. I remember the first time, I went to Howard University in Washington, D.C., and I remember the first time I drove from Washington, D.C. down to Jacksonville, Florida. And I entered into right outside of Fayetteville. And as I was going into the city of Fayetteville on the outskirts, they had this huge sign, a billboard. And on that billboard was a hooded figure sitting on a horse. It was the KKK figure on this horse with the sign saying, "You are now entering Klan country. Join the United Klansmen of America." Well, I didn't take them up on their offer and join, but I can tell you, I don't think I stopped the car until I got to Florida. I'm from upstate New York, and driving through the South like that for the first time, that was really an eye-opener for me. Yep, sitting on top of a horse, join the United Klansmen of America. We had only heard about those kind of things. You see it on TV. Now, this was the early 70s, by the way. You see it on TV. You see it in the movies. That movie, by the way, Birth of a Nation, really took on it was a big issue around the turn of the century. And that movie also was one that created a lot of animosity, even more so, toward blacks. And I know recently, I didn't see the recent one, but there's a recent version of that movie as well. I haven't had a chance to see it, but apparently the original ones were not good at all. Birth of a Nation, that's an old black and white movie as well. So at any rate, those are the basic areas that I wanted to talk about today. And if you have any comments, now's the time. If you want to call in, I got a few minutes left. And while I'm doing that, I want to, you know, mention to the business owners that are out there, et cetera, that one of the things that we do are site assessments on behalf of our clients when we go out and we assess whether or not the facility that they're in is a secure facility, et cetera. We assist with writing the workplace security plans. You know, when I go out to some of these places these days, it's amazing how people really rally to this because we have so many concerns in this area. And I have a team of highly qualified individuals that are working with me. But, you know, some people take this a little bit more serious than others. We've had clients that have actually called us and told us that, you know, based upon the information that we gave them, it really worked well for them. And that's always good to know. But I stress to you all the time that you also have to take accountability for your own safety, your own awareness. You have to pay attention to what's going on around you. If you're out and about in the general public, you know, be conscientious. And I'm not telling you to be paranoid. I'm telling you that you got to be paying attention, because these situations can change people's lives very quickly. And you got to understand that if there's people out there that are willing to hurt people, innocent people, then we need to be on our guard just a little bit more. These open forum situations, if you're at a concert, don't be in the middle of the crowd. Be to the outside of the crowd and always know where the barriers are. Barriers is something I talk about all the time, so that if something happens, you can always go behind the barrier. So that should be kind of like the first thing that you do when you get out there. Now, other situations that are out there, law enforcement, you know, these are individuals that are really putting their lives on the line for you. Please respect them. When I see police officers, I normally tell them, "Hey, be safe out there." And I mean that sincerely, not just because I was a police officer, but because of the fact that they're trying to do the job to protect us all. Unfortunately, on the news today, and I hate to even bring this up, because for the last 3 weeks now, I've had to report back to you about a police officer getting killed. And here was a black police officer that was shot and killed last night. I believe it was in Georgia. And, you know, here's a person now whose family is going to be deprived of his lover's comfort. And, you know, all because of a criminal that took his life. And, you know, these shootings aren't just, you know, white cops being shot. It's police officers in general. And that's the shame of it. There's 42, I think the number now is that 42 police officers have been killed this year. And, you know, in the performance of their duty. And that's a shame. You know, I really wish some of that violence would stop. I'm not defending bad police officers that are out there, because there are some apparently, but so many of them out there really trying to do the job for us. All right, you've been listening to Jim Potts on LA Talk Radio. It's time to close out the show, but let me remind you that you can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/JimPottsAuthor. Be sure to join me next week. If you like what you heard, spread the word. Until then, be aware, be vigilant, and be safe.
You're listening to Listen Up with Jim Potts, only on LA Talk Radio.